This is Floss Weekly with Chris DeBona, Episode 2 for April 14th, 2006. Ben Goodger of the Firefox Project. Once again, we travel via the magic of the internet to Mountain View, California, where Chris DeBona is holed up in his lair, his open source lair. Hey, Chris.
Hi. How are you, Leo?
I'm great. It's great. We had a great response to Floss number one. I want to thank everybody. The only negative, can you guess?
The music.
So it was a little bit of a downer.
Yeah, so we should come up with something snappier.
Well, you know what I'm going to do is, it's an open source podcast. Anybody who has a suggestion.
Send me links.
Has to be Creative Commons, obviously.
Yeah.
We'll give you a plug.
And nothing like too like boop, 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 boop.
No. It has to reflect the seriousness of Chris's demeanor.
Let's not make it all like music. And
well, what do you want? What are you looking for?
Well, I'm not looking for anything. I don't want
to
like.
It needs to be. It needs to be upbeat because people need to be happy.
Certainly
at the beginning of the show, and as you can see, when we play that song at the beginning, as much as I actually really like it, and we should give credit to Greg Cucciaro for doing it. It's great music,
but
you need to be more upbeat at the beginning.
Well, you know that was actually part of that was from the game that I was working on before. I was at Google. It was part of the background soundtrack for the melancholy bits.
Well, why did you choose that, Chris?
Well, it was
melancholy.
Free. I owned it, and I can put it out there and not worry about rights and stuff. And
yeah. All right. Well, we just anything pod safe. We'd love to entertain your submissions.
Sure. Definitely upbeat. Not too like, Bunting's World on computers. Or
No. People know that. People know that you're hip, man.
Well, okay.
it should sound like a penguin and a demon
fighting.
Thank you. I almost said mating, which really wouldn't be right. So Ben Goodger is back. We're so happy to have him back. I mean, people who are listening to this podcast say, "What do you mean he's back?" But we did a whole episode with Ben. But the timing's very good because Firefox 2 is in pre-release, and we could talk a little bit about that. Tell us what Ben does.
Ben? Hi.
Hey, Ben. you tell us what you do.
What do I do? Well, I am the module owner for the Firefox browser in the Mozilla project. And what that means I get to do is to take part and sort of help guide a bunch of the engineering work that gets done for Firefox releases. Writing code, reviewing code, thinking about what should go into new releases and, all that sort of stuff.
Are you particularly user interface focused?
Yes. The section of code that I work on is almost entirely user interface and various application pieces like that. The rendering engine is separate.
So we should talk a little bit about the structure of Firefox because it's unique and it's actually brilliant. And it's a lot of the power of Firefox comes from the structure.
How did you actually, get into Firefox in the first place, Ben?
Well, Firefox is interesting. Like, Mozilla before it and the Netscape 6 and 7 product lines, the user interface sections are built using a XML language to define how the user interface looks. It's very similar to HTML, if you want to think of it that way. With tags for buttons and menus and text boxes and so on. And as a result, it makes it easy for people who have a web development background, who know JavaScript and HTML and stuff like that, to actually get involved with coding the browser user interface itself. And that's how I got involved, because I was a web developer, and I saw that the code was something that I could understand and modify. So because of the open source, I was able to get involved with the Mozilla project that way.
Are you talking about...
And how old were you?
Oh, yeah, this is good.
I was in my second year of college at that point, and I was 19.
So you weren't even old enough to drink in this country.
No, although I was in my home country.
Which is New Zealand.
Yes.
Okay.
So are you talking about Zool, then, when you're talking about that part of the user interface, XUL?
Yes, Zool is the XML user interface language, and that provides these capabilities.
So as a web developer, you're used to XML. It's not like writing C code or Python or something.
Right. It wasn't something that was completely foreign. It wasn't even, you know, like a resource script or something like that that you'll find with some user interface systems. It actually looked a lot like HTML. So yeah, it was very the accessibility of the code from that perspective was very good.
So you started with Mozilla and you ripped out stuff?
Well, at the time that I joined the project, the decision had just been made to switch from using the legacy Netscape rendering engine to Gecko, which was a newer, more standards-compliant rendering engine. And as part of that switch, the decision was made to build an entirely new browser user interface and mail and editor user interface using the rendering engine itself to develop with Zool. That happened, I think, towards the end of 1998. And by early to mid-1999, that was underway. But many, many features had not been implemented yet. And a lot of the user interfaces that existed were in the sort of preliminary states. So I saw that as an opportunity to get involved, you know, with the sort of thing that I was interested in, which was building user interfaces. So I began to help, you know, clean up the preliminary user interfaces, fill them out, add features, and you know, add polish and stuff like that. And it was as a result of that that I was able to get a job at Netscape and continue doing that throughout the next few years, and then eventually work on Firefox.
And those were pretty turbulent years, weren't they? I mean, didn't like AOL and Sun and someone else create like a troika of companies to administer the old Mozilla stuff?
Mozilla was always run by the set of people that populate the leadership of Mozilla even today, but except in the Netscape days, Mozilla was a department within Netscape. So certainly, you know, there were, you know, interesting and challenging times over the past few years, but, you know, I think that the main difference has been the independence of Mozilla as various project management pieces from Netscape. That's one of the largest changes that's occurred.
Well, maybe we should highlight how Mozilla even came about. I mean, it was originally Netscape.
Yes. So at some point, and I don't know a great deal about this because, you know, coming up through the open source community, I wasn't part of Netscape at the time when the decision was made to go open source. But I assume that there was a point at which the management there felt that it would be worthwhile to try and get more help, you know, in all areas with building their products. And, you know, web browsers are really, really complicated things. And it's, you know, I can only imagine how difficult it would be to build one as closed source without the testing help that comes from, you know, open source communities and without the development help that comes from open source communities and localization and all these other things. So I think that they had, you know, realized that they'd done a good job with releasing products in the past, but it was getting more and more difficult, especially that their use of this as a revenue channel was evaporating. So,
yeah, I mean, IE was pretty free at that point.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, I remember talking to Mark Andreessen right about when IE 3.0 came out. And actually, I interviewed him before then, but I talked a little bit about it on the TV, and I said basically Netscape should pack it up because now that Microsoft was at version 3, it was a pretty credible threat. And I remember Mark Andreessen was pretty mad at me, although it was shortly after that Netscape did in fact pack it in. So I wasn't far off.
It was a strong product at the time.
Oh, and well, it was the smartest thing they could do was to donate it to the open source community. Although I remember at the time and for some time after that, the Mozilla project was almost really an example of what doesn't work about open source. It struggled for a while.
Yeah, a lot
it?
Of people characterized it as a failure born out of desperation, you know? And I remember hearing that when it happened, and I thought, well, I hope that's not the case, and I think it stinks that that's how it's being portrayed, right? But I think that, you know, in a lot of ways, sort of the coming of Firefox changed that idea in people's head that maybe it was, wow, a really good idea to release this because look at this thing that came out of it.
Yeah, I mean, now it's the poster child. I mean, that and Apache are the poster child for and Linux, of course, for the success of open source.
Yeah. I mean, I agree, obviously. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this show. But yeah, you know, one of the things that always really I thought was like super amazing about Firefox and to a lesser degree Mozilla, but the extensions and the themes and the plugins and all this stuff, but the extensions being written in Zool mostly were pretty remarkable. And did that just come as part of Firefox? Was there something about Mozilla before that made that easier? Tell us the story of the extensions, Ben.
So extensions are interesting, and they certainly date back to, you know, the original architecture of the new Mozilla browsers. Zool supports an extensibility mechanism where, you know, third-party components can insert new pieces of user interface and functionality. And that was always present. It just never worked particularly well. Like you couldn't, once you'd installed something, you couldn't easily remove it. So what Firefox did was add the sort of management piece, which was to allow users to go and download and install these things and then disable them and uninstall them and all that sort of stuff. And at the same time, with the release of Firefox 1.0, Mozilla launched its add-ons site where it distributed a number of these things and, you know, made it really easy for people to go and get them and learn about them and, you know, read other people's comments and all that sort of stuff. So I think that sort of seeding of the ecosystem and that sort of critical mass of functionality enabled them to be more successful than they had been in years past.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm looking at my list of extensions now. Do you have any favorite extensions, Ben?
I have a few that I quite like. Some of them have ended up making their way into the actual default Firefox builds, like the one that lets you drag tabs around.
Yeah, that's pretty great.
I also like Bug Me Not as a way to get past free registration for free sites. And there's one that lets you resize text areas on web pages. Oftentimes,
oh, for like Gmail?
You find text areas too small and you want to make it bigger. And you can just drag and size
instead of just the whole page, just an area of the page, a region of the page.
You know, like a text box for email or whatever. Sometimes
so I'm going to go do that. You guys have fun with the radio show.
Oh, I see what you mean, the editing box. Yeah, Gmail would be, it really could benefit from that, couldn't it? Yeah.
For sure.
You can have too many extensions, though, can't you?
Well, certainly. I mean, sometimes, you know, extensions will try and, you know, interact with the same part of the browser, and there can be problems if that happens.
I just noticed it slows it down if you really...
Yeah, some of them really
laid them on.
I mean, you know, within the browser itself, we paid a lot of attention to trying to keep things fast. You know,
snappy.
We do, you know, all these sorts of optimizations, and extensions, you know, don't always get the benefit of being inside the browser, so they need to do things that are either different or, you know, maybe sometimes they don't know about the optimizations that we've made, so, you know, they do things that cause slowdowns. So, you know, one extension by itself, you might not notice it, but once you get, you know, several that are all doing this,
or then, 20.
Or 20, or, you know, 100, like that guy who posted screenshots somewhere.
It's tempting, though. You really want to deck this thing out. They're all so cool.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's like, I'm looking at my own list right now. I've got the full screen Homestar Runner, you know. Very important.
That's an extension?
Yeah, because, you know, Homestar is usually like, you know, just this little box, and then it basically takes the entire, you know, flash and makes it fill the available screen.
Wow. Talk about a dedicated extension.
See how important that would be.
Yeah, you can't live without that. I use the Delicious extension, which is an example of a simple area of functionality.
Sure.
But it's just great. I mean,
Flash Block. I love Flash Block.
It turns off the flash.
You have to actually hit something, and then it starts. It's like, wow.
Ben, when you talk about optimization, we might as well bring up this. I'm sure it's a sore subject and something you don't want to hear about anymore, but this prefetching issue, which you talked about in your blog, and I think really diffused, but people called it a memory leak in Firefox.
Well, I think that the back and forward page cache is one of the ways in which Firefox can use more memory than you might think. I'm sure that there are actual leaks there, and I'm sure that, you know, there are, you know, extensions that leak more memory than the base browser itself. So I think that it's a really complex problem, but certainly the back and forward cache is one use, one place where Firefox 1.5's memory usage is higher than previous versions.
Can you describe what it did so people understand what you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, 'cause you're talking prefetch. Yeah.
So, well, basically, this is one of the areas where I think that the benefit that you get is often, you know, better than the additional performance requirements on your system. What this thing does is, as you browse around and you click on links and you navigate from page to page, the browser downloads the HTML and pictures and parses it and keeps it in your cache. Now, with previous versions of Firefox, when you'd hit back, it would have to go and fetch that data from the cache and reparse it and lay it out again. What Firefox 1.5 does is it caches the actual visual representation of that as it is rendered, so that when you go back, it is instantaneous. There's no sort of lag that you sometimes get as it, you know, reparses and renders something from scratch. So the effect of going back and forward is instantaneous, which makes the browser feel a whole lot better, faster and snappier. So we thought that, you know, despite the, you know, potential increase for memory usage, that this was a worthwhile thing to take. So that's sort of an explanation of the feature and the rationale behind including it.
But people all sort of characterized it as a memory leak, which was that frustrating?
Well, I mean, insofar as this is the source of people's higher memory usage, then it can be frustrating. I mean,
it can also be shut off.
But you can shut it off, and sometimes, you know, if we're not running up against... If your system is you know, has plenty of memory, then it's a great thing to have. If you're sort of running into the limit of how much memory you have, then maybe it's not the best thing. But I think that it's not necessarily the, you know, the only cause of higher memory usage. So I wouldn't be too quick to turn it off if I were a user. I would look to see you know, what extensions I have, and maybe try running Firefox in a safe mode and see if it uses less memory in that case, and maybe it's an extension or a combination of extensions that's contributing to it too, and you sort of have to decide then whether you like the extension so much that you want to keep it, or you want to try and reclaim some memory by turning off the back and forward cache, or what. So, you know, it's a bunch of trade-offs.
It sort of reminds me of how a number of support organizations are now handling when somebody says, I have Grease Monkey and it's doing this now. You know, they basically will say, well, we're not going to support it because you're doing something off, you know, center.
Grease Monkey is another really cool extension that just shows you power of extensions. You want to describe that a little bit?
Well, Grease Monkey is an extension itself that supplies its own extension platform that lets people write scripts that get inserted into websites and run to change the appearance of a website when you navigate to it. So you could... There was a popular Grease Monkey script that started off as a Grease Monkey script and then became an extension in its own right called BookBurrow, where you would go to Amazon. If you had this Grease Monkey script installed, it would show you how much the same book cost at you know, Powell's or Barnes & Noble, or, so that you could you know, figure out if you wanted to buy it from here or somewhere else.
I can see why Amazon would complain about that behavior.
Well, did they complain? I don't remember.
Well, they can't, though. It's your
browser.
What can they do?
Yeah, I think, you know, you might pay more money from one place just so that you can get it shipped and get free shipping. I don't
know.
But, you know, I think ultimately it helps. You know, things like that help e-commerce on the web more than hinder them. You know, I just think, you know, if people want to go to the extent of, you know, writing scripts to block ads, then, you know, they're probably not going to be the same users that
are going to click on them
and, yeah, you know, buy stuff from you. So,
as long as we're debunking rumors, we might as well debunk the Firefox 3.0 release rumor. You want?
Well, this is an interesting thing, and this is something that, you know, in times past we've been fairly careful about, and I think maybe we just overlooked it this time, which is what happened was for the main development trunk, that's a word that describes the section of source code where a lot of active development is going on for a future version of Firefox. The version number in the source code was changed to 3.0 because in some time, you know, however many months, Firefox 3.0 will ship from that code. And as such, automated nightly builds began to be produced saying that there were Firefox 3.0 Alpha 1. And whenever that happens, someone usually notices this and then posts it to Slashdot or Dig or wherever else onto their blog. And, you know, that it looks like a release has happened. So I think the thing that people have seen that looks like Firefox 3.0 Alpha 1 is not actually Firefox 3.0 Alpha 1. It's something considerably scarier, and it's definitely not for your average user's consumption, or even people who would usually test beta releases may not like to test this build because It changes from day to day, and there could be data loss issues. There could be, you know, crashes and all kinds of things like that.
So when you run Firefox, do you run out of the CVS builds, the nightly builds, or do you run a more stable version?
It depends. You know, oftentimes I'll run a more stable version, or I'll have a version of a set of my own changes that I will run. But most recently, I've just been running a nightly build.
Eat your own dog food.
Yes. Yes, that's...
Also, you know, it's worth pointing out the safe mode works pretty well on these, yeah. Do you know what safe mode is? So, Tell us about safe mode, Ben.
So, on Windows, there's a shortcut for it in the program folder that got created for Firefox. And on Linux, I think you run with the -safe -mode command line flag. And what that does is it runs Firefox with all of your extensions disabled and the default theme picked versus whatever else you might have selected.
So it's a way of backing out if you installed a really foul extension or something.
Yeah, and you can go in there and you can uninstall the extension that you think did it or try disabling things and all that sort of stuff. So it's a way to get your browser back in case something bad happens.
Not that anything would ever happen bad.
Well, I don't know. I mean, during the transition from
there were Windows
7 to 1.5, all the extensions that I was running,
a lot of them broke,
barfed, and couldn't really run it. So
we are kind of looking at 2.0 right now, though. Yes,
that's where a lot of active development is going on. Yes, for 2.0, and so a number of us are working on a whole set of new features for that release,
such as.
Well, I'm so glad you are.
That was a pregnant pause.
See, this is great because, like, if he was selling, like, you know, an iPod or some, like, you know, hardware thing, and he was making money from it, this would be like, they're just like this big ad for something,
right?
But we're talking about this open source project, so we can have fun with it and we can talk about it.
And yeah, I love it. And I have to also say, engineers are always more fun to talk to than marketing people because engineers, you know, they live in a black and white universe. Things are true or not true.
And they work or they don't work.
Yeah. And it's very straightforward. And it's not like the kind of gray area that marketers live in, let's face it.
Well, I think, Leo, you're ignoring the possibilities of a right-side infrastructure for your enterprise. Because
that's
where the action really is, brother.
So let's just get back on target. What's new in 2.0?
So there's a whole bunch of things, actually. One of the things that myself and a few of the folks here at Google are working on... have been doing a lot of work on lately is a entirely new bookmarks and history system. And this system replaces the one that's been in Mozilla for many years. And it uses SQLite, which is another open source project, as its back end, and supports a fairly advanced query system on top of it that allows us to do all kinds of interesting features, showing all of your live bookmarks, subscriptions in the same folder, in a single folder, and various neat things like that. So that's one of the things that we're working on for Firefox 2. And also, as part of that, trying to make it easier for people to add bookmarks and browse their history and find pages that they've been to in the past. So that's one thing. A whole bunch of other things, trying to improve the search experience, RSS and feed viewing experience. Tab browsing is significantly enhanced with Firefox 2.
You finally have an Xbox in the tabs.
Yeah, I mean, we did some user studies, and we found that people weren't noticing the one over on the right. And one of the things we're trying to do for Firefox 2 is make... We think tabs are a great way to browse, and as a result, we're making it so that when people click on links that would open new windows, we're going to make them open tabs.
Good.
So as we do that, we need to make tabs... have the same level of usability as Windows do in people's minds. And people know how to close Windows, so they need to be able to know how to close tabs.
That sounds like something fairly uncommon in open source development, actual user interface testing. how formalized is it on the Mozilla project or on Firefox?
Just historically, there hasn't been a lot of formalized user testing just because the people that are involved generally... people have some people have a sense of, what will work and what won't work. And the flexibility of the technology that we build with allows us to make changes and see if they work. And if they don't work, with people testing, nightly builds and all that sort of stuff and giving feedback, then we can change it to something that does work better. And so that's sort of a pattern that's repeated over and over. But more recently, we've been able to actually do some user testing.
Like the kind Microsoft does, one-way mirrors, focus groups, that kind of stuff?
Yes, that sort of stuff.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, we have a little padded room we trick people
into. Well, and it does raise an issue, and I probably should bring this up too, since we're hitting all the hot button subjects. A recent blog post claimed that Firefox was making, what was it, something like $17 million a year on the Google search bar in Firefox. And in fact, that Firefox is actually a very profitable company. Do you want to address that? I know it's not your area, Ben.
Well, this is kind of a tricky area because we both work for Google.
Yeah, maybe you should address this, Chris.
No. So who was it that did a blog post about this from the Mozilla Foundation, Ben?
I think it was Chris Blizzard.
Yeah, Chris Blizzard did a post about this that was pretty succinct. That dead air you're hearing is me going,
Do you want to summarize, or do you want to not get involved at all?
I think I should not get involved. Okay. Yeah. You know, just one of those things. We support a great number of open source projects. We support the kernel significantly. We support a great number of projects.
Nobody's saying
and
that.
In fact, Summer of Code, by the time that this goes up on iTunes, will be launched to the mentoring organizations. We won't quite be taking student applications yet. That's May 1st. But
that's neat.
You know, we're going to do summer code again this year and all the rest. So.
We'll put links in the show notes. If you send them to me, Chris, I'll put them in the show notes.
Yeah, no, I'll
want
do
to get
that.
Involved.
That,
yeah,
sure.
I think that's great. Yeah. I'm not asking to, and I'm not want to start some conspiracy theory or anything like that. Not in the least. And I'm sure Apple probably makes money too from referral links and so forth from the Google search window and its toolbar. Merely, I guess what I'm saying is Mozilla financially in good shape? Can I talk Mozilla or Firefox? What organization?
Well, it's Mozilla Foundation and the Mozilla Corporation.
Okay.
I honestly, for the life of me, don't really understand the difference. So
Firefox
much.
Is
and
the
I know
product,
I should,
I guess.
But I don't. Yeah. Well, Firefox is what they ship. It's
right.
not the company.
Right.
So
I mean, if there must be some, I'm sure there's some revenue from that. I'm not going to speculate. And I think
they're doing
to speculate. They're doing well, aren't they?
Yeah.
Ben's just sitting there.
Ben's like, I don't know what to say.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Ben. Did I mention my Homestar Runner extension?
It's not your area, and maybe Mike Belsner or somebody else should be addressing it more. But nevertheless,
we could bring over somebody from the Foundation.
Yeah, where's the money? Show me the money.
Show me the money.
All I'm saying is that's great. I don't think anybody begrudges that. I think that that's fantastic that... and I think that was the point of the original blog posting. Look, it's possible to have an open source project that is financially viable.
Sure.
Without charging
that,
for the software.
I think what we're most worried about, and I'm sure the Mozilla Foundation is most worried about, is we don't have undue influence on this project. I mean, that's not how we work. It's not the goal by any measure. Any sort of ad sharing deal is pretty secret stuff, period, because that's just who we are about ad sharing deals.
Right.
But... So, it's not like nefarious.
So yeah, okay. So we'll just leave it at that. I just want to we're talking.
So
about
So I
this
give
stuff.
You my word that I'm not nefarious. I mean,
I believe you. You're not evil.
Yeah. Well, that's why I work here.
Even though there's a little devil on your shoulder in the album art.
Well, BSD people are evil. No, I'm kidding.
Oh,
please,
good.
Please, Mark, I'm kidding.
Marshall
I'm kidding.
Is going to pull it. We have to redo
I'll
the
have
art.
To go and buy him drinks. And
we
stuff.
Like BSD.
And Kirk Mucusik's a fine fellow.
Yes, he is. Yeah. So let's talk about the timetable for 2.0. Is how far off is? I mean, you just released 1.5, not so long ago, like 3 or 4 months.
Yeah, are you increasing the number of releases, like speed-wise?
We haven't done enough releases to be able to really establish any kind of pattern. generally, before 1.0, we did pre-releases about once every 3 months, but that was in pre-release time, and we could really ship it in all kinds of different states. But now, we have more visibility, and doing a release is a lot more complicated. So our plan is to generally for a release cycle do a number of alpha releases, which establish the set of features that will be in a release and make it so that it's functionally usable and all that sort of stuff, and release that to sort of a set of people who are interested in testing things of that quality, people like developers and so on. And then a wider testing with beta releases to, interested early adopters and so on. And then hit the final release. And as far as, when that actually ends up being, we don't know. I mean, the target was sort of towards sometime in Q3, I think it was initially. It could be that it's towards the middle of the year. It could be later. It depends on... how we're doing in fulfilling the requirements that we established, at the start of the release cycle and what the quality of the software is at that point in time. You know, we don't want to, you know, one of the things that's made Firefox successful is that it, you know, with 1.0 released, reached a level of, you know, stability and compatibility and performance that really made it useful to people. And we don't want to do anything that would compromise that by releasing too soon or anything like
and
that.
And there's no, like, I mean, it's open source, right? So you don't have to worry so much about, like, needing some marketing deadline or anything like that? Or
no, no, not so much. I mean, so, sometimes it's it can be useful to think about those things when...
You mean, like, Vista and stuff coming out, that sort of thing? Do you care about that? I mean...
You know, I'm not so much... Personally, I'm not so much focused on doing things, you know, like beating Microsoft or any of that, just trying to make good software. But it's nice to, you know, have good stories written about you and stuff like that, and to release, you know, like at the right time of the week and stuff like that, so that you get the most coverage and all that sort of stuff, so that people will actually come and find and use the software, which is what we really want people to do, is to come and try Firefox and try the other Mozilla products.
So releasing at 1 o'clock on Sunday, not really what you do.
It's, you know, that's that.
Because the media is lazy. That's lazy.
It's true. Speaking as a media, media whore, I'll tell you that. You timed 1.5 very well, and it was a big splash, and a lot of people paid attention to it.
Well, you know, what better thing could you want for Christmas than Firefox 1.5?
Yeah. Mac users, of course, are asking for the universal binary. You could build it now from source, I presume.
Oh, yeah, what's
the
story with that? Do you know?
So I think support for that now exists.
In source, if you compile the source, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it was intended to go out with 1.502, but that didn't quite happen. So I think 1.503 may have universal binary support for Mac users, and certainly Firefox 2 will have it.
Yeah, because I guess if it's not universal, it doesn't run so hot on the Intel Mac.
It's a little slow on the Intel Mac. You kind of want to run either Safari, which comes with it, or, of course, Camino, which is universal. But with Camino, you don't get Zool, so there's always something you have to give up.
Yeah, it's trade-offs.
Camino runs very well, though, on the Intel Mac. It's very slick. Maybe you should explain, Ben, all of these little...
What is Camino? What is...
All of these bifurcations. And SeaMonkey. Yeah, exactly. All these... What's going on?
I mean, what's wrong with you?
No. It's not him. I don't blame Ben.
No, I think it's great, actually. I mean, it's one of these, it shows you how, you know, open source in general works, and that people have ideas and different ways of doing things. And, you know, they pursue them, and that's what they're interested in. And it's because of everybody, you know, working together and on different things at the same time that we get a lot of benefit from what they bring to the table. Like, for instance, people like Mike Pinkerton, who leads the Camino project, and the people that work specifically for Camino, on Camino, they are very experienced Mac programmers. And because of their work there, the Mac version of Firefox is improved as well, because a lot of the, you know, rendering technology underneath is shared, and they contribute to the Mac version of that. So, you know, everyone wins. And also, just because, you know, there are a lot of browsers around, it's not necessarily a bad thing. It means that lots of people find this problem interesting and are, you know, researching new ways of doing things more efficiently or that are better for the user. And so by having, you know, giving people that freedom to explore and experiment, you know, all of the projects can benefit.
I think it's really important. You know, and the thing is, so can I tell you my pet peeve?
Yes.
Leo? Please. I'm going to tell it to you.
Peeve away.
So one of the things I've heard over the last decade around open source software is this phrase, and it drives me crazy. Do you want to know what it is?
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you.
Yeah.
And it's this. Boy, they must have a lot of time on their hands. Whenever I hear that, I want to slug somebody.
The theory,
I'm not
being
a violent man.
If you didn't have a lot of time in your hands, why would you waste your time on a free software project?
Oh, God, like,
I mean, don't you have anything
isn't that stuff
better to do?
Done?
Yeah,
you have anything better to do? And it's like, you know, I think about the computer business, and I think of how much of it came from people doing things on
absolutely
their own, having fun.
Yeah,
and you know, I hate to say it, we're not cave people anymore. We're not out hunting bison on the plains or whatever the heck cave people did, you know, scratching their meager existence while dying at 20 and having high infant mortality and all that stuff. It's like, well, what's the point of civilization if we can't spend our time on intellectually interesting pursuits that generate great things like open source software?
I agree 100%.
I mean, Firefox was a huge waste of time until it wasn't.
And then it was vital and everyone's using it. Oh my God, it's so great. Right. So that was my pet peeve and I'll calm down.
No, and I'm sure that this is actually something we'll hit again and again on this show because it's the nature of open source, you know, and that's what makes open source fantastic is people pursuing their passion.
I'm actually typing into Google. They must have a lot of time on their hands as a search.
And here's the thing is that when people are doing things that they are genuinely interested in, you know, they will do, you know, the result of that will be so much better. It'll be, you know, pure, if you will. And you'll get things, you know, things will happen from that might not happen otherwise because, you know, when you're trying to do something because you're scrambling around to find ways to make money or stuff like that, you might not, you know, have the time to stop and think about what really the best thing is for you or for other people like yourself.
That's exactly what podcasting is all about. So, you know, you're preaching to the converted here because, I mean, people ask me all the time, you know, what are you doing? You spend most of your time now producing free programming. What are you, crazy? you know, advertising free and revenue free. But it's, you do it for fun. And, you know, what's great about it is in the long run, I think you get some benefit. You will get benefit. And certainly users get benefit.
Well, you've gotten some advertisers on some of the programs.
We have. And yeah. And I certainly don't intend to, you know, I hope to make money on this. I'm not going to eschew monetary success by any means to channel William F. Buckley. Yeah. But on the other hand, you know, we do it for fun right now and it's perfectly fun. Let's talk about the fact that Camino is done by Mac enthusiasts who want to write something in Cocoa, but they're building on a foundation that's common to all of the Firefoxes, which is Gecko.
Yes.
Talk about Gecko.
So Gecko is the cross-platform rendering engine that's sort of at the core of a whole bunch of projects like Firefox and Camino, but also the Thunderbird Mail Reader or Chadzilla IRC client, and actually a whole bunch of other projects out there too, like the Songbird MP3 player.
That's right.
And stuff like that. So it's basically a very powerful, extensible, standards compliant.
So basically everything within the borders of a Firefox window that's running Gecko.
Yes. So all of the UIs.
So people get an idea.
That's the browser. The rendering engine. Is that a good way to describe
it? It's the rendering engine. It's the window widgets. Yeah.
All of that sort of stuff. Everything except for the outside of the window and the title bar and the little closed box and all that sort of stuff.
You know, where you have the X and the...
Right.
Or on the Mac, those little glowy boxes.
Yeah, that comes from the operating system, but everything inside that...
So menus, you know, toolbars, everything.
It's all done by Gecko. So there are many, many capabilities within that system to, you know, not just do HTML, but things like Zool, render Zool, and, you know, other languages like SVG and stuff like that. So... It's very, very capable. Most of that is written in such a way that it works on a bunch of different platforms, Windows, Macintosh, Linux, and a whole bunch of other things that are less common, like BIOS or...
I like how he says that.
And I get chuckly.
And OS2. OS2, yeah. OS2.
And VMS and OS360. All right, sorry, I'll stop.
Just the way the software is written is such that, you know, there are pieces of the code that are designed to be these sort of portability layers that provide different you know, operating system services using a sort of a neutral interface to the rest of the application so that the rest of the application can be written in a cross-platform fashion. And that's what allows applications like Firefox, like Thunderbird, and so on to be shipped across all of these platforms. And the other thing that it allows is that, you know, not everyone has Windows or not everyone has Macintosh, et cetera, et cetera. So
No, wait. So not everyone has Windows or Macintosh.
Yes.
Well, then what do they do? Who are these Philistines?
Well, some people like to use Linux or
BSD. Like Ubuntu, like I use?
Yes. And it allows people who... it allows everyone to contribute to the project and improve the software across every platform.
Right.
You know, people. Right. You know, say you're a person who's localizing for your regional language and you only have Linux. Well, the localization piece is fairly cross-platform. You can still write strings. You don't need to be a Windows person to write strings or a Mac person to write strings. If you're using Linux, you can still translate the software into your language, and all of a sudden, they're, you know, the Firefox is released in your language. So, you know, it provides a way for people to contribute.
What is Sea Monkey?
Sea Monkey is...
Didn't you ever read comic books, Leo?
No, sorry.
Besides something you really don't want to buy from the back of a comic book.
One year at Netscape, as a gift, they gave everybody Sea Monkeys.
Oh, really? Is that where the name came from?
Yes, that's where it came from. It was the more sanitized version of another name, which we weren't allowed to name the project.
Was it dirty?
A little bit, yes.
Like filthy dirty? Like don't say it on a podcast dirty? With iTunes dirty?
Come on, tell us. I'll bleep it if it's really awful.
Butt monkey.
as in the Wayne's World. Monkeys might fly out of my butt. Like it'll never happen. That kind of monkey.
That's probably the case.
The genesis. So
marketing folk or the HR folk or whoever, I don't know, decided that it would be better if I had another name. So Sea Monkey was chosen. That was
because Butt Monkey. There's something wrong with that.
It was a copyright issue, I'm sure.
Yeah. It's one of those really popular things.
ButtMonkey.com complained.
ButtMonkey.com complained.
Folks, do not surf to ButtMonkey.com. I don't know what's there, but I can guarantee you.
So, you know, I'm of course going.
Yeah, you don't want to see it, whatever it is. So what is Sea Monkey, though?
So Sea Monkey is the name for the Mozilla application suite. And that is the single product that includes a web browser, a mail reader, a web page editor, IRC clients,
car wash,
a whole bunch of different capabilities. And it is sort of a spiritual successor of the Netscape Communicator product line.
So for some reason, I got the impression that the Mozilla Foundation had kind of abandoned this idea of a suite in favor of the, you know, singles, you know, light applications, Firefox and Thunderbird what is it? It's new. They made Composer into something else. New, anyway.
NVU,
that's it.
Well, is that really Composer, though? I mean, it seems like that was started from scratch as well.
I think, it shared a lot of the, you know, it used a lot of the code and inspiration in much the same way Firefox did from Sea Monkey. Firefox sort of grew out of the browser component of Sea Monkey, and NVU and Thunderbird grew out of the web page editing and mail components of Sea Monkey. So I don't think that there are new productized releases of Sea Monkey available from the Mozilla Corporation, who handles all of the Firefox distribution these days. But I think that there is still a active community of contributors who support that project and contribute to it through the facilities provided by the Mozilla project.
Yeah, because it still lives on the Mozilla.org site.
Right. Sure. And so the people that contribute to that project, make releases of it when, they think that they're ready to release, much the same way Camino does releases. It's not a Mozilla.com product, but...
Or Mozilla Foundation people, even.
Yeah, necessarily.
It's because it's open source. That's what confuses people, because you say, well, is Microsoft developing this or not? And you can give a yes or no answer, but it's a little different in the open source world.
Right. Vive la difference.
Well, that's great, yeah. And for people who miss the communicator and the suite, you still get it.
Yep. Right.
As long as there's demand, I guess, for a particular kind of product, somebody's going to develop it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Because we're the people. We are.
Wow. Maybe we should have called this We're the People.
Nah, that wouldn't be like too. We haven't been expecting hate speech that fades out every time you go under a bridge.
Yeah. Welcome to World of People.
That was a right-wing joke.
Are there any other branches that are major branches? We've talked about Sea Monkey, NVU, of course, Firefox and Thunderbird, which are kind of the mainstream.
Well, didn't Thunderbird just come out a Thunderbird 2 sort of thing late fall 2006? I'm seeing this here.
Is that coming? Thunderbird 2?
I think so, yeah. Thunderbird 2
project. I love Thunderbird.
I'm looking at the page right now.
How much code in common is there between Firefox and Thunderbird? Is it uses some Zool stuff, right?
Thunderbird, like Firefox, is built on Zool, and it uses Gecko to render itself, and uses the same widget toolkit and a lot of the same utility functions, et cetera, that Firefox uses. The major differences are that it's a mail reader, and so it has its own user interface for that, and the set of things required to open your inbox and all that sort of stuff. So That itself was sort of a fairly significant lump of code. Probably, I imagine maybe 2 or 3 megabytes worth of the download size of Thunderbird code specific to Thunderbird. And Thunderbird generally follows the same release track as Firefox. That if we
because Firefox is hot,
if we go off on a brunch, then Thunderbird will follow the same brunch and release about the same time.
Yeah. So I'm looking at their roadmap right now. It looks like they're working on new kinds of course, spam detection and anti-phishing stuff. And it looks like they're redoing their labeling system, sort of more taggy, more blocky taggy, is my guess. So there's lots of little interesting things here if you go to their page.
I really think that Firefox and Thunderbird are just a wonderful example of how good open source software can be. And I think it's very important that they exist, because for the naysayers who say, oh, no, people will never develop great software. This proves it completely wrong. I mean, it is the best browser out there. It's the best email client out there. I mean, even if you didn't agree with that, at least you would say it's certainly in a class of with all the others, or all the best other choices.
All of the software, I think, are very credible. Pieces of software. They're not toys. They're Firefox, Thunderbird, Camino, etc. They're professional software products, that people can use everything. Yeah. I recommend that, if you want different perspectives on Mozilla, to talk to people like Scott McGregor and Mike Pinkerton, and get their views about things. So they're excellent contributors to the cause.
How many people are on the Firefox team? I mean,
how many are you working
hundreds?
So that's a very difficult question to answer. Within sort of the browser front end,
they're beyond numbers, Leo. No, all right, go ahead.
Within the working on the browser front end, maybe 20 people. Some people who work at companies like Google or Mozilla Corporation, and then people who volunteer their time. And that number might be accurate, or it might represent the sum of half time people, etc. And then at other, different levels of things, people who work on Gecko, et cetera, maybe, I don't know how many people work on it, maybe 50 or 60 additional people work on that part, or even 100. And then in addition to that, there's all of the people who test and file bugs and write test cases.
And the endless number of people who write extensions and themes.
And you start getting into the hundreds and thousands at this point. It swells out from there. And the barrier to contribute to projects like Firefox and Thunderbird, et cetera, is very low. I mean, you just need to go and get, a nightly build or an alpha release or something like that, and start using it and filing bugs and helping developers reproduce test cases and all that sort of stuff. That's just an invaluable contribution that anybody can make. It's a large community, and it's one that I would like to see grow more in the future, because I think we can do many interesting things.
So you welcome new people. Do you have to be a super duper programmer to even consider working on the team?
No, I mean, for many of the reasons that I've said, you can improve Firefox just by using it and filing bugs, the design and architecture of the system is such that the code is more accessible to web developer types, for instance. You don't need to be a hardcore C or C++ hacker to even get your foot in the door. We try and make sure that our code is designed well no matter what language it's written in, but there are plenty of people around in the project who are experienced and will give advice to people who are new or old about how best to do things and make sure that the end result is as good as it can be.
And it's pretty darn good.
It is.
Well done. There you have it. The inside look. So what are you just like, okay, you're going to go back to your desk now, Ben. What are you going to sit down and start working on?
I have been working on a couple of things. One is just continuing to fix bugs in the new bookmark and history system. Making sure that when you drag and drop your bookmarks around, they don't disappear.
Good thing.
Is that bad?
people don't, you know, the experience that I've had with working on bookmarks and Firefox and Mozilla is that people don't generally respond to losing their bookmarks well.
No, don't like that.
Who knew? I don't know. I thought many of the people would be happy about it because, you know, cleared away a lot of the clutter from their
life. All the cruft in their life.
Yes, but for some reason they like to keep them. So I've got to try and keep working on some of those things. And also the other thing I've been doing this week, just because it's another thing that's on the 2.0 list and is interesting, is trying to make RSS preview work better. So right now, Firefox 1X, if you click on one of those subscribe or XML links that people put on their blogs, and there's an RSS feed, what you often get is a bunch of raw XML.
Yeah, that confuses people, even though there's built-in RSS support in Firefox.
Well, you know, it's really funny you brought this up. I don't know if you want to go into this. I don't know how much time you want to spend.
Let's go. I love it.
So a friend of ours, Ian Hickson, he's on the WhatWG, which is like this HTML5 stuff. He wrote this great post on his blog, and we should really, really link to it. Basically saying that, you know, content types on the web are basically just utterly broken and ignored by browsers, because browsers are always trying to discover things like, you know, RSS feeds and all the rest, and how, you know, RSS producers rarely pass on the right content types. And it's a fairly dense technical discussion, but it's pretty interesting, I think. So.
Well, will microformats solve that? I mean, is that the way to go with this? I mean, that's the kind of new buzzword, I guess, around all this.
Will microformat solve this?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I really don't know. Yeah. I'm not really a microformat dude because I don't know a lot about it.
Well, I mean, that's the...
I guess Ian, though.
That's the...
He's saying no. He's
no?
Like, no.
Yeah.
No,
yeah. So, I mean, I think that's the really... That's what we're trying to do, is figure out a kind of universal formats for all of these things. And I frankly think RSS, despite all the infighting in the various camps at RSS, actually works very well.
Well, you know, I'm actually a really big supporter of just embedding cool information inside RSS, mostly because... Yeah.
It's a universal
file
format.
Read it.
Exactly.
And even if it just looks kind of like plain when you load it into your favorite reader or aggregator, it's right. there, right?
It's
so
there.
If you subscribe to, say, a calendar, hey, look, my wife just added this to her calendar, that
right.
kind of thing. Right?
I agree.
So that's kind of cool. You know?
I agree. No, in fact, I do almost everything. My to-do list is an RSS feed. My calendar is an RSS feed.
Right.
And I think it makes a lot of sense. And I think the way Firefox handles it, which is if you bookmark an RSS feed, then you can see the items in the feed as a drop-down menu from the bookmark, works quite well.
Yeah. Well, speaking of bookmarks, Ben, what are you going to do with bookmarks? Can you talk about it? Do you talk about it?
Yeah. I mean, the sort of stuff that we're doing is we're making them easier to search, more convenient, and also easier to add them. And the problem I think a lot of people have with bookmarks is, well, for one, a lot of people don't use bookmarks because I'm not sure that they know how easy it is to add them. So we want to try and make it easy for people to add pages because... You might dog ear a page in a book or insert a sticky flag or something like that when you're reading or doing some research. And, you know, bookmarking a page, marking it as interesting should be that simple. And it should also be easy to find that page later. And you shouldn't necessarily be forced to do a lot of organization. You know, historically, people have made folders to organize their information. But, you know, people organize their folders... organize their bookmarks in folders about as often as they organize anything else in their lives.
That's really true.
So, I mean, some people are very organized and some people aren't. And I think if you asked everybody whether they thought they should be organized, everyone would say yes, but whether or not they actually did it, it's a different story. So.
Yeah, and everyone cleans their bathroom every week.
I would guess that most people, I mean, this is how I use it. I don't know. You tell me if this is what your research shows, but I would guess that the toolbar is, you know, commonly used in dragging things to the toolbar, but that's got very limited real estate. And I rarely go into my bookmarks proper. I just use the toolbar and folders on the toolbar to kind of get to the stuff I most commonly use.
Yeah, I'm looking at the same thing on mine here.
Yeah. And even then, I mean, a lot of people don't, you know, a lot of novice users don't necessarily even know how to use that.
Right.
Because for all intents and purposes, IE doesn't have one because they have it hidden by
right.
default.
Right.
So it's just the toolbar. It's an invaluable
feature. It's a wonderful, yeah. But I also use, as I mentioned, this delicious extension. It's clear that no browser right now does a very good job with bookmarks. I don't know if it's a metaphor issue or what, but I can't wait to see what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot of the work that we're doing is some of the things that we are doing will be sort of incremental improvements and, you know, try and expose things in a more interesting or useful way. And a bunch of the other work that we're doing is providing a platform upon which we can build more interesting features in the future and also allow extensions to build really interesting features. With the design, I tried to make it so that the live bookmarks, the RSS folder feature, was written as much as possible like an extension would be, so that we could get an idea of what extension authors, issues that they might have to face, so that we could make the system more capable for them, so that people will build interesting things on top of the system.
People, the rap on user interface design is that engineers are doing it, and they understand how this stuff works better than real people. But I can see, Ben, that you do think about how real people are using this stuff. Is it a stretch for you, knowing as well as you do how to use the program, to think about how novices use it?
Yes, it can be, and that's why I think it's we have to remind ourselves at times, what that's like for even other advanced users who aren't those of us who build the software,
right?
To actually go and watch people using it and see what people notice and what they don't notice, and that's where usability tests are
vital.
They're a reality check for anyone who builds user interface applications.
Well, we could, obviously we could talk to Ben all day, and I think we should save a little bit so that we can have Ben back and talk to him some more. I've asked him every question I had to ask, and I'm really glad that we could talk to him. It's great.
One thing I'll mention that we sort of got at the end of the last recording that I thought was particularly useful, and if you turned on the recorder again so that we could get it, was just for me to evangelize the smart keyword functionality within Firefox.
Oh, yeah. That's really cool.
I asked what happened last time, and again, this is the recording lost to the ages, but I asked Ben, what are some features?
Shared history founded upon the Barack site.
What are some of the features that you like the most in Firefox that you think people don't know about? And this keyword is it blew me away. I'd never
seen
it before.
Once you start using it, it's just awesome.
Yeah, I've used it ever since. Go ahead, tell us about it.
Go.
So what you can do is that any site that you would go to search over that site, you can go to that site, like say IMDb, and you can right click on the box that you type your search keywords into, and choose this item in the context menu called Add Keyword for the Search. And then you give it basically creates a bookmark, and you give it a keyword like IMDb. And then from then on, once you've added that bookmark, you can type in the location bar of the browser IMDb space and then a set of search terms like, V is for Vendetta.
A good movie.
I like that movie. Now, don't beat up on that.
My friend Jeremy loves that movie.
It wasn't bad. Well, there's some flaws, but we'll do movie reviews on another podcast. Open source movie reviews.
This thing sucks.
So how does Ben know that that's a search box? I mean, that's got to be some serious Zool foo you got going on there.
Well, it's just it understands the way HTML works and understands that this text box is inside a form, and forms get submitted, and forms are often search engines. So what it will do basically is it recreates that submission when you do it through the location bar,
right?
Using your set of terms as the input, rather than you having to go to the web page and clicking in a text box and typing it in yourself.
So I went to my blog, which has kind of basic search functionality. I right click on the search box, and sure enough, there it is on the right click. Add.
Now you can search you whenever you want.
Add a keyword for the search; it becomes a bookmark. I mean, it's little things like that that are just so cool. But I don't think anybody knows about it. I'd never heard of it.
That's the thing. One of the things that we'd like to look at for 2.0 is, if you go to a certain site like IMDb and search a certain number of times, like say you go there 5 times, it's likely that you search that site a fair amount. Well, wouldn't you like to have that happen for you, or wouldn't you like to be told that you could do this, since you're going to that site all the time and searching? So
this is risky, though, because now you're entering Microsoft territory.
Right. How is
I see you've done this search 5 times.
Oh, the clippy.
Would you like us to make this be an automatic search for you? I want every time, Microsoft does this in all of its applications. It doesn't even does it in the user in the operating system, and it drives
me. Yeah, but that little clippy has a gun. No,
okay. The idea is to, try and find a way to make it not be obnoxious.
Right,
if it's still subtle that, 85% of people miss it. The fact that 15% of people get it, and whereas before only 1% of people got it,
right,
that's still an improvement.
No, it's tricky because you want to expose these features, and that's obviously what Microsoft's responding to. But you have to do it in a way that it doesn't annoy people, I guess.
Right.
Yeah, that's I guess both the challenge and I'm sure the pleasure of user interface design. When you get it right, it's so good.
Yeah, very satisfying.
Yeah, that's neat. What a pleasure to talk to you, Ben. Thank you for giving us a second chance.
Yeah, thanks, Ben.
Oh, it was great.
Should I start the recorder now?
Hard. death.
No, I have it all. I do. I have it all. And I'm making three copies. And this time I'm not editing it on Windows, okay?
Okay, good. He hit a button.
Audacity.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, it was Windows Media Player that did it to me.
Oh, yeah, I quite believe that.
That application doesn't love you.
I deserve what happened to me on that one.
Well, you don't deserve to be.
It erased all the media.
Well, you were
from my
asking for it, Leo.
I was asking for it by using Microsoft Windows, I think. Guess. Anyway, thank you so much, Ben, for your hard work on the user interface and for joining us on Floss Weekly.
Well, thank you for chatting.
So we're going to put a lot of links, I think, in the show notes to this. In fact, Chris,
yeah, I just forwarded you a whole whack of
thank you. So. I was just going to ask you to do that so I can get them in there. And we'll be back next Friday. I declared, Chris, the week after Easter to be podcast catch-up week. And
cool.
So some of the podcasts early in the week we're not going to do, just to give people some time to listen to their, you know, because people I know get a whole bunch of podcasts and they never get around to listening to them. So we're going to do this. Yeah.
What's more important, their families and vacations or
but we
this
are,
podcast?
We are going to, we'll do one later in the week because this is a new podcast. We want everybody to get hooked.
Yeah, and I guess, what's next week? Yeah, so some weeks coming up, I'm going to PenguinCon.
PenguinCon? You know,
that conference in Michigan.
Wow.
So it's should be fun.
Will we get penguin interviews from that?
I will do that. I'll take my rig and
that'd be fantastic.
I'll find anyone.
That'd be fantastic.
Who loves science fiction and say, what do you love about Linux?
It's a science fiction and linguist and
well,
Linux.
It's funny. It's a combo. It's science fiction and Linux and games and gaming.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's a nice little show.
So. Oh, so and there'll be some interesting people, like I'm sure Neal Stephenson will show up and some. I mean, there are a lot of sci-fi
that would
authors.
Be awesome. If Neal Stephenson show up, I would be basically kissing his feet.
Me too. Me too.
So, yeah, PenguinCon is, you can find that on the interweb that we've seen so much about.
And we
you
thank
can
you
use
for
this Firefox thing.
What is this thing called Firefox? We thank you, Ben Goodger. We thank you, Chris DeBona. And we most of all thank you, our fearless audience, for joining us once again on episode 2 of Floss Weekly. We'll be back next week with more free, libre, and open source software for your amusement and bemusement.
And maybe with better music, too.
Yeah, send us your samples, send us your ideas, send us your suggestions. Take care.